Well, good morning, everyone. Bright and early. I obviously have the most difficult job today to be the first speaker, but I'll try and wake everyone up a little bit. It's really a pleasure for me to be here. I was a fresher at Warwick in the Pace Department 10 years ago this year, so it's really kind of satisfying for me to be able to come back and talk to this audience. And when I was here as a student, the big issue in international politics, the big issue in development at that time was trade. And the big push was really for a fair deal at the WTO. And the nice thing is that that was what we were studying here at Warwick as Pays students, but it's also what Oxfam was campaigning on at the time with the Make Trade Fair campaign. And that was really the first really big global campaign from Oxfam. So it's really nice for me to come back sort of 10 years on and talk about our new campaign, which we've just launched, which is called Grow, and I'm going to get into that in a bit. The guys at WIDS asked me to say a few words about how I got here after leaving Warwick. And it's, you know, I know it's a really daunting time, I think, to be an undergraduate and to graduate in these economic circumstances. And I don't envy any of you. And I know it's really kind of frightening to be in the final year at the moment and think about, you know, jobs and what on earth you're going to do with your lives. I mean, I think, you know, I don't have any great advice except to say that, you know, nothing that I did was really particularly planned. And certainly in the final year, I didn't know what I was going to do. And I just sort of took different opportunities as they came up and struggled a bit and didn't have any money for a long time and, you know, took a lot of badly paid jobs for a long time just to try and get some experience. And then, you know, it happened to be in the right place at the right time to get the kind of the job in Oxfam, which, you know, I was really fortunate for. So I spent a year after graduating, did a little bit of traveling, you know, did one of those jobs fundraising on the street, stopping people. That's not great. I don't recommend that. Especially in the middle of winter. I managed to get a job in a community centre in Earl's Court in London, which was really great and taught me a lot about kind of marginalised people in inner London. And then I went and did a master's in Belgium. I think one of the real kind of scary things as an undergraduate is often you want to carry on studying, but it's so expensive. If you think it's expensive now to be an undergraduate in this country, it's even more expensive, of course, to be a postgraduate. And, you know, I didn't have £12,000 to pay for a master's at the LSE, for example. So I was looking around for kind of funding opportunities abroad. I hadn't had an Erasmus year either, so I felt, you know, I needed to, you know, get involved. So I found some funding to study in a place called the College of Europe in Belgium. So I sort of specialised a bit in European politics. I came back, I did some internships in the UK afterwards, unpaid, really tough. Managed to do an internship at a think tank called Demos. That was great, taught me a lot, but it was a struggle because it was unpaid. And then got a break working for the Fabian Society, which is a think tank affiliated to the Labour Party, where actually I was an events manager and was organising conferences a little bit like this. And so I know pretty well all of the stress that the WIDS team will have gone through to put on an event like this. So, you know, they deserve a lot of credit, I'm sure. From there, I went back to Brussels and got into climate change because this was in 2008 when the big package of legislation in Europe was around climate change. It was the so-called climate and energy package, which was about passing the 20% reduction targets for emissions, 20% of energy coming from renewable sources and 20% energy efficiency gains by 2020, which was a huge package of European legislation. So it's really exciting to be working on that. And I worked for the network of NGOs working on climate change in Europe called Climate Action Network Europe. And from there, I was in the right place at the right time, really, in the Copenhagen year in 2009, when an opportunity came up at Oxfam. In Brussels, so I started working for Oxfam. Learned a lot. I'm sure Robin knows well. It's a brilliant organisation to work for. There's lots of opportunities in Oxfam all over the organisation, so do keep an eye out if you're interested. On the website, there's always different opportunities coming up all around the world and here in the UK. Don't ask me about it because, you know, I'm not able to help anybody get a job, but it's, you know, it's definitely a great organisation to work for, lots of passionate people, and lots of people working incredibly hard and incredibly long hours, and getting incredibly tired in the process. But that was a really great opportunity. So I was there with Oxfam in the Copenhagen Summit in 2009, and then just before the Cancun Climate Summit last year, I came over to the UK to take on the role that I'm doing at the moment, which is as the climate change policy lead for Oxfam on international climate change policy. So that's a bit about me. You know, as I said, there's no great words of wisdom in that. It's just to say that none of that was ever mapped out. I never kind of had some great plan that that's, you know, that's what I would do. And I think, you know, just take the opportunities that come up, you know, each year, and in the end, cobble together a career pathway and, you know, see how you get on. But don't be too daunted, because, you know, things don't always work out so badly as they might seem at some point on the road. Okay, so the presentation is about climate change, and it's about Oxfam's new GROW campaign, which is a campaign for food justice in a resource-constrained world. So I'm going to look particularly at the climate change aspects of that. So what am I going to talk about? I'll give you like an introduction to the big picture behind the campaign, which is really about resource scarcity, how that relates to hunger, and why, in the end, Oxfam is campaigning on this issue. And I'll focus in particular on the climate change aspects of the campaign, which is what I'm responsible for. I'll say just a little bit about Oxfam's work on the ground with communities in adapting to climate change, and then talk about some of the key issues which are around adaptation and adaptation financing, which we're hoping to get addressed at the next round of UN climate talks, which are starting a week on Monday in Durban, South Africa. And then I'm just going to finish with some thoughts about the Rio Plus 20 conference, which is a summit happening next year, June next year in Brazil, to mark the 20th anniversary of the Rio Earth Summit in 1992. So these are three statistics to keep in mind, I think, throughout all of this. And they talk about the huge demand for natural resources that we face in the decades ahead. Demand for food likely to rise by around 50% by 2030. The Food and Agriculture Organization suggests it will be around 70% by 2050. That's a huge growth in demand for food. Huge growth in demand also for energy, around 50% by 2030. And a huge demand in growth for fresh water resources, around 30% by 2030. There are different numbers out there you can find. These are the numbers that John Beddington ran with when he produced a big report for the UK government last year called The Future of Food and Farming. And he called this a sort of a perfect storm. You know, look, you know, this is a coming resource crunch. It's a huge demand growth. Why have we got this kind of growth? Well, part of it, of course, is because we've got a growing global population. We're already at 7 billion this year, and most people think we'll hit around 9 billion by about 2050. But it's not; it can't just be explained by population, because actually the big population growth happens in the poorest countries in the world. And as we know, it's the poorest people that do not have the access and are not using up the resources. So actually much of this demand is coming from increasing affluence, which is a good thing normally. Countries like China, other emerging economies, who are shifting increasingly to more Western so-called developed lifestyles. And it's really that, I think, which has more to do with this growth in demand. So the key question then for development really in the 21st century is whether we're going to be able to meet this demand. Can we? Will supply meet the demand? And if not, what are the implications for the poorest people on this planet? Are they going to get squeezed out? And critically for Oxfam, we're looking in this new campaign at what the implications for the food system are of this coming resource crunch. So what does so-called food justice in a resource-constrained world look like, and where do we start in trying to tackle it? And we've already got some warning signs about this coming resource crunch. After decades of slow but steady progress in the right direction, the number of people going to bed hungry every night has taken a sharp turn for the worst in the last 10 years or so. And peaked, or for the first time, passed the 1 billion mark in the food crisis of 2008. And although the number then came down a little bit again, we're projecting that it's going to go up again and continue to stay much higher than it has in recent decades. And that's for a number of reasons, and I'm going to look at some of them just very quickly, and then I'll focus on climate change. It's partly because of increasingly volatile food prices on global markets and local markets. It's partly because of rising energy prices, partly because of an historic underinvestment in smallholder agriculture. It's partly because of insecure land tenure, and that's something, of course, that Robin's going to talk much more about, I'm sure. And exacerbating all of these underlying tensions is climate change, which is just making it all a hell of a lot worse. So behind this story, then, we have to bear this in mind. There's a historic trend, a collapse, really, in public investment in agriculture in developing countries. So this is the proportion of ODA worldwide directed to agriculture, and as the trend is pretty clear, and it's pretty depressing. Why have we had this kind of a historic decline? I mean, part of it is explained by something that I learned a lot about when I was here at Warwick, which are the structural adjustment policies promoted by the international financial institutions in the 1980s as the new sort of development model, in which developing countries, as I'm sure this audience knows well, were encouraged, if not forced, to scale back on public investment of all sorts. And that included cutting back drastically on public investment in agriculture. So that's investment in research and development, for example, into new seeds, new technologies to help smallholders. Cutbacks, in particular, on what are called extension services. So these are the sorts of services that are critical to getting new knowledge, new techniques to farmers out there in the field, which used to be a huge publicly funded good, public good provided by developing country governments for smallholder farmers to help them, for example, to better market their crops, to get their crops into local markets, to earn a living, to deal with new technologies, and to really help them on their path out of poverty. And there were huge cutbacks in all of that area, and instead the economic model for agriculture shifted to one which was private sector led, private sector investment coming in to really drive forward some sort of green revolution model, which was very resource intensive, based on high inputs, largely through the application of new fertilizers at massive scale. And that's very well suited, or it had been, particularly to large farms, industrial scale farms, particularly in the north. And of course, there were smallholder farmers in developing countries who are the vast majority of farmers around the world, and who represent a huge proportion of the poorest people on this planet. It was they that were losing out. And one of the things that's interesting is that resource-intensive model, it wasn't just that it was better for big industrial farms than it was for smallholder farmers. It's now running out of steam. There's only so much fertilizer that you can keep piling into your soil to get returns, to get yield growth in return. And those returns are now starting to dry up. You know, the soil, that planet in the end only has a sort of a natural carrying capacity. You can't keep on just adding more fertilizer and getting more yield growth. And we're starting to see those yields start to flatline, or the yield growth, I should say, start to flatline, and is starting not to keep pace with population growth and with growing demand. So let's bear that in mind. Next, this is perhaps the new period of food price volatility. It's not kind of a historically unprecedented. In the 1970s, we had huge, even more extreme food price volatility. But it is a new era, which is having a massive impact on the lives of poor people and on their ability to work their way out of hunger. You can see clearly here the spike in food prices around about the 2008 food crisis, which is, of course, maps directly onto that big spike in the number of people going hungry every night around the same period. So why have we got this? Again, you know, lots of economists out there, Oxfam out there, trying to figure out what are the different causes of this new volatility of food prices. Part of it is around demand and that shift to sort of Western lifestyles, eating more meat in China, for example. In other developing countries, meat needs to be fed, and that uses a lot of land. So you've got You've got this huge new demand. It's partly linked to rising and volatile energy prices. Food markets and energy markets have all sorts of interconnections. For example, the transportation costs will rise if energy prices rise, so the transportation costs of getting your crops into market. The fertilizer costs rise hugely if energy costs rise, and often that's the first way that poor farmers in developing countries will feel the pinch from rising energy prices. Biofuels is a major factor of this spike around 2008. Why is that? It's basically a supply shock to the food system, because all of a sudden when you get high energy prices, it becomes profitable, competitive, to invest in biofuels as an alternative source of energy. So what happens is that farmers around the world, particularly in developed countries, start, instead of growing crops to put in people's bellies, they start growing crops to put in cars. So of course you get a shrinking supply of the food and the prices rocket as a result. The other factor, and this is very closely related to my area, of course, of climate change, were extreme weather events, which again provided a shock to the system. And in 2008 in particular, you know, the Russian wheat harvest suffered a massive shock from a heat wave in Russia. And these are the sorts of shocks that can hit at any time, and I'll talk more about that in a moment. And the final kind of factor that people are trying to get their heads around is this part of the story of this increased food price volatility is around speculation on food in global financial markets. And, you know, it's a devilishly complicated area. There is no smoking gun to suggest that this new, huge new wave of speculation on food markets by people sitting behind desks in the City of London, for example, is necessarily driving this kind of added volatility. But there's really strong circumstantial evidence. Basically, you can map against the huge increase in this type of speculation, maps exactly against the increase in volatility that we see in this graph. So there's a whole load of factors in there, but certainly this is one of the factors which is pushing more people into hunger. Next up, land, and this of course is something that Robin's going to talk about much more. All of these growth in demand means there's a huge new pressure and competition on land. And as this graph shows, the share of land which is devoted to agriculture has now peaked, and it's not going to get any bigger. So previously, maybe if we needed to respond to new demand for food, well, we just, you know, expand the area of production of agriculture, and maybe chop down trees and expand agriculture into forests. Well, we can't do that anymore. So there is now a growing scarcity of land, and therefore a growing competition over land, and that's one of the reasons, one of the factors driving so-called land grabs, which I know that Robin's going to talk much more about, and I think knows much more than me about. So there's a huge new demand for land. It's driving competition. But critically, it means that we can't, in order to respond to this growing demand, we can't just hope to expand the area of production. So that brings us to climate change, because if we can't just expand the area under production, it means that we need to get more out of the land that we currently have. But that's at a time when climate change is actually acting as a drag on the yields of key crops. So this is an academic audience, so I put in some academic references to some papers looking at projecting ahead at what the impacts of climate change on yields of key crops are. And there's different studies out there, but I just picked a few. Important study by Peng that looked at what the impacts on temperature rises on the yields of rice, for example, and they found that for every 1 degree increase in nighttime temperatures in the growing season for rice, you could get a decline of around 10% in yields. The big study in this area was by Klein in 2007, who suggested that developing countries could experience declines of around 15 to 26% by the second half of this century, and that could be as high as 50% in some developing countries like Senegal, Sudan, some of the most impacted sub-Saharan countries. Big regional disparities in these numbers, but I'll just give you some of the headlines. Or studies by IFPRI looking at suggesting that climate change could reduce yields of wheat. But the story here is really that, you know, these yield declines start to bite by around 2030, but then they increase by 2015. By the second half of this century, they get really frightening. And this is a really scary picture for me. This is this indicates the decline in the length of growing period for key crops in Africa in a world which is warmed by 4 degrees above pre-industrial levels by the end of the century. So the dark areas in the map indicate a shrinking in the length of growing period for crops, so the period in which you can grow crops literally, of 20% or more. So you've got these two dark bands indicating big falls in the growing period across southern Africa and across the Sahel. And only a few, very few speckles of green, which indicate a lengthening of the growing period, actually around the Horn of Africa, ironically, because of course that's the area in Africa which is perhaps suffering the most right now from famine and a really unbelievable food crisis. And of course, these declines in yields driven by climate change has an impact on prices. It's another supply shock. So when you're producing less, the price is going to increase. And there was a study from earlier this year by LaBelle at the University of Stanford and his team. And he actually quantified for the first time, not just looking ahead at what the future impacts on prices might be of these declines in yields, but looking back over the last 30 years and seeing, has there been a decline that we can attribute to climate change? And if so, what have been the impacts of that decline on food prices? And they find that from 1980 to 2008, there's been a decline of around 4% in the maize yields of maize and around 2 or 3% in the yields of wheat compared to a scenario where you didn't have climate change. And principally what they found, it was rising temperatures which make the biggest difference. We have to think about rising temperatures and changing rainfall patterns. But what most of the literature suggests is actually it's rising temperatures that have the biggest impact on yields. That's what we have to worry about. So you've already had this decline, and then they calculate that those declines have been responsible for an increase in world food prices of around 6% for those two commodities over that period. Now that doesn't sound like a lot. That's around an additional $50 billion per year that the world is spending on food already as a result of climate change. 6% may not sound like that much, but the story is that this is already starting to bite. We can already see it over the last 30 years. So when we look ahead, we should be really worried, and we have to learn something about this trend. So as part of the launch of the GROW campaign from Oxfam, we commissioned the Institute of Development Studies at the University of Sussex to look ahead for the next 20 years to 2030 and project what impact climate change would have on food prices. So these are some of the findings. The productivity and output of key crops is going to decline as a result of climate change. Maize is a crop which is particularly susceptible to increases in temperature. So you can see across Africa there are big declines in South and Southeastern Africa, declines of up to 35% by 2030 compared to 2010 as a result of climate change. And then the graph on the right as you look at it, looking at the percent changes in domestic output of key crops, Brazilian wheat clearly hugely affected as well, falls of around 20% and so on. So these, we can already see these yield shocks start to take effect even by 2030. And as I said before, of course, when you get yield shocks, when the supply shrinks, prices rise. And so we looked at what implications that would have for food prices by 2030. And the green bars indicate a scenario, a modelled scenario without the impacts of climate change. And then the shaded bars indicate what might happen if we put climate change into the picture. So the story is that, look, food prices are going to rise anyway. You know, this is not solely being driven by climate change. It's all of those other factors that I touched on earlier. But the fact is that climate change exacerbates it. It's going to make it very much worse. So we can, you know, we can say things like, well, perhaps by 2030, food prices are likely to double, but around half of that is being driven by climate change. But it need not necessarily be so. there are things that we can do. By investing in the appropriate adaptation strategies for farmers, we can lessen the impact of climate change on those rising costs. So this is a part of the model that puts in investment in adaptation, and we can see that with the right investments, food prices still likely to rise, but to a lesser extent than they would if we didn't invest in adaptation. But all of these impacts of climate change on food production and consequent impacts on prices, this is only modelling slow onset effects of climate change, principally temperature rise and changes in rainfall patterns. So these are a slow underlying trend. But of course, climate change is not just doesn't just impact on food and agriculture through slow onset declines in yields in that way. It also makes extreme weather events, droughts, floods, etc., more likely. So this is a picture from the flooding in Pakistan a year or so ago, and I think the lady's point is where her house stood. And the point is that you have this underlying trend, this sort of insidious march of climate change, which is declining yields and making it harder for farmers to eke out a living. And then on top of that, you can lay these shocks, climate-related extreme weather events, which we all kind of pretty much figured were becoming more frequent and or more severe in developing countries. So, I mean, Oxfam's done some sort of studying on this. The report by UNCTAD in 2010, you know, is impressive to me. They found that compared to the 1970s, the last decade saw a fivefold increase in the frequency of extreme weather events hitting the poorest countries, the LDCs, the least developed countries. And I didn't get a chance to put this into the PowerPoint presentation, but yesterday in Kampala, the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, launched a special report looking at the linkages between climate change and extreme weather events. And the story is of this ever more clear link between man-made climate change, man-made greenhouse gas emissions, and an increasing frequency and severity of extreme weather events. It's not the same picture everywhere globally. There are differences in different regions and for different types of event, but that link is becoming ever clearer and ever more undeniable. And of course, those types of shocks themselves have a massive impact on food prices. And one of the pieces of work that we're working on right now that we'll bring out, some of the early work just before, next week actually, before the Durban Climate Talks, is looking at, over the last year, what have been the impacts of extreme weather events on food prices. And of course, the story is actually really quite clear. When we look at the current famine, the drought in the Horn of Africa, what's happened to food prices in the region? They've risen hundreds of percent, hundreds of percent. Now, if you're a poor farmer or a poor person in urban areas, you probably spend around 50% of your income on food. Some much more than that, up to 70% or so. So if you get a sudden spike in the food price, you can imagine just how difficult it is to keep your family out of hunger. So we're going to look at, we have to bear in mind both this slow onset impact of climate change, dragging yields down and therefore pushing prices up over time, and then lay on top of that these shocks driven by extreme weather events, which cause added volatility in the markets and make it even more difficult for people to keep themselves out of hunger. And then the final way that Oxfam has found, when we talk with farmers in developing countries, that they're experiencing climate change at the moment and have been over the last number of years, the way that they talk about it is in terms of an increasing unpredictability in seasons. So what they mean is rains starting at different times, or rains during the rainy season, perhaps it's dry for a number of days, and then all the rain falls in sudden heavy downbursts. So this makes it really difficult for a farmer in a developing country. Basically, you've got one or two chances per year to grow crops, one or two cropping seasons. So the decision about when you plant those crops is absolutely critical for your livelihood. If you get that wrong, that's it. You haven't got a buffer stock to fall back on. You haven't got that resilience to deal with those types of shocks. You want those crops to grow, to harvest them, to yield to the maximum possible extent, and hopefully you'll get a decent price when they do, depending on what's happening on global markets, and hopefully then you can continue to feed your family and start to make your way out of poverty that year. if the rains come at a different time, perhaps your seeds die before they germinate, or perhaps they just start to germinate and then you get a sudden downburst of rain and it destroys the seedlings before they've really started to flourish. So this is how farmers are telling us, and there was an important paper which we wrote in 2009 looking at these shifts in the seasons. So as I was just suggesting, you know, we need to understand what the linkages then are between climate change, hunger, and vulnerability. And this is where, you know, it's really important that we have gender at the heart of our analysis, because what we find is that it's women that often have the least resources to adapt to these types of changes. They don't, without the sort of adequate incomes, savings, access to healthcare, or other forms of social protection, they're forced into short-term coping strategies and sort of things. First and foremost, they'll go without food, and it's often women that will be the first to go without food in a family. They'll sell off assets that are critical to their livelihood, so they'll sell off livestock, for example, sell off goats or cows or whatever they've got. Well, once they're sold, they're never going to help you out again. They just help to get you through that current crisis. Or they take their children out of school to work, for example. And the point is that these types of short-term coping strategies can have long-term effects, which really span the generation. So women first to go without food, malnourished, give birth to low birth weight babies, and that cycle of deprivation continues across the generations. Okay, so that's a bit the background then to this campaign. As I said, it's not that you can't do anything about it. And as the numbers showed, it's really important that we do something about it, principally that we start to invest massively in adaptation to climate change for the world's poorest people. And so I'm just going to say something, give a sense of some of Oxfam's kind of programmatic work towards climate change in developing countries, working with poor communities to adapt to a changing climate. So this is a kind of conceptual diagram trying to capture some of Oxfam's approach to adaptation work. So I won't kind of go into it too much. I mean, it's a little bit abstract, really, but it shows that we put communities at the heart of the work, but we recognise that you need to address climate change across multiple levels, subnational, national, global, at the household level, etc. We recognise that you've got to both build capacity to adapt, but also address the factors which limit adaptive capacity. So taking on gender inequalities, for example, is critical. It's a critical adaptation strategy. And what one of the things that climate change, you know, means is that we're not just dealing with knowns. I don't want to sound like Donald Rumsfeld or something, but it's, you know, the point about climate change is that we don't really know what necessarily is going to happen, and we need to build in flexibility and agility to be able to both deal with hazards that we think and know are going to strike, but also to manage risks and uncertainty going ahead. Then I just kind of put in a bit of a table with some of the sorts of interventions that this all leads to on the ground. So if the climatic change, which is having an effect, is an increase in temperature on land and water, and perhaps the impact, therefore, on farmers is an increased heat stress on crops, then the sort of intervention that perhaps we'll try to design and work with them to implement could be improving their access to heat-tolerant or drought-resistant seeds or crops, for example. I won't go through the list, but it's just a few ideas of the sorts of things that we can do working with communities. And really, you know, one of the stories is that there's a lot of solutions out there. Often the solutions come from traditional indigenous knowledge from local communities, and really a lot of the job of adaptation is making sure that you empower and put in the driver's seat those communities, because it's they that really know what they need to adapt to a changing climate, and we need to work to empower them to do that, not impose solutions from the outside. So last part of the presentation, they're just looking at some of the kind of background challenges then at an international level to this adaptation agenda, and I'm going to say something about therefore what we want to get out of Durban in a week or so's time. So the first thing to note is that adaptation is expensive. You know, this is not development as usual. this is a new challenge, it's a new crisis, and it comes with new costs. So it means that you can't just try to mainstream climate change into your existing climate, existing development policy with the same money and expect to be able to deal with the problem, which is what many, many developed countries are trying to suggest is possible. So there's a number of studies over recent years looking at what the scale of adaptation investment worldwide could be in the years ahead. And actually, Oxfam was one of the first organisations to come out with a number relatively early on in 2007. And we suggested that the adaptation needs at that stage were somewhere in the order of around $50 billion per year, starting immediately. And critically, that that would need to be on top of existing commitments to scale up development aid to the 0.7% of GNI target. And then thereafter, a number of other studies, all of which seem to indicate that actually the scale was of needs was even very much higher than that. And the most, I mean, including from, you know, from the World Bank, you know, that indicated up to $100 billion a year was needed. But perhaps the most interesting study, the most recent one, is by Martin Parry and his team, indicating that actually, you know what, all of these recent estimates of adaptation, they said, they weren't even coming close. It wasn't a case of kind of 50 or 100 billion. It was hundreds of billions which was going to be needed per year by 2030. And critically, they said that that had to be on top, again, of the existing flows of development assistance. So the need is great. We've got to find money, and it's got to be new money. And yet, at the same time, adaptation is currently chronically underfunded worldwide. So the relatively small amounts of financing, international financing, which are flowing to deal with climate change in poor countries, is overwhelmingly flowing for mitigation, for emission reductions in developing countries, rather than to adaptation. It's what we've tried to coin in Oxfam, the adaptation gap in climate finance flows. I mean, the number kind of moves around a little bit, depending, you know, depending on where you are in the year and so on, but it's something like around 10 to 20% of current flows of climate finance internationally are flowing to adaptation. So that's a huge imbalance, and something which we're really trying to campaign and advocate to see addressed. And in the Copenhagen Accord, which was this political agreement signed between heads of state and government in 2009 in Copenhagen, there was a commitment to so-called fast start finance, which was $30 billion over 3 years, 2010, 2011, 2012. And that agreement included the requirement that there should be balance in that fast start finance between adaptation and mitigation. And what we're seeing is anything but balance, or any kind of understanding of balance, you know, that is sort of reasonable. So the Netherlands giving all their money to mitigation. They're not actually the worst players, really, the Netherlands, so we should let them off a bit. But France, you know, 20% going to adaptation. Norway, normally very progressive, you know, only giving 10 or 12%. Canada, around the same. USA, less than 10%. So the story is really clear. All the money is flowing to mitigation. Adaptation is losing out. And as I said before, most of the resources which are flowing at the moment, which are labelled adaptation investment by developed countries, the vast majority is not new money at all. It's just a relabelling of current commitments, existing commitments for development assistance, which all of a sudden they say, oh, well, now we've got these climate financing obligations, we'll just relabel this, we'll call this particular commitment adaptation now, or we'll double count something that we were already investing anyway. So it's just sort of old wine in new bottles. So this there's a permanent need to maintain pressure on developed countries to explain how the resources that they're providing to tackle climate change are new and additional. This is the phrase in the UN climate negotiations which really matters. And we continue to put pressure on trying to seek a fair definition of this phrase, new and additional. So we need new sources of finance, as we can see. That's one of Oxfam's overriding kind of missions at the moment in the fight against climate change. We've got to find new money to get into adaptation. This year, the COP is in Durban, in South Africa, the Conference of the Parties. Some people are saying this is the African COP, suggesting this is the first time almost that the climate negotiations have gone to Africa. It's actually not. It's actually the third time that the UN climate talks are taking place in Africa. And 10 years ago was the first time, which was in Marrakesh in 2001. And at Marrakesh, there was a lot of talk, as there is this year, about the way that Africa in particular is being impacted, the poorest countries in particular, are being impacted by climate change. And there was a commitment made to the poorest countries by developed countries. And the commitment was to fully fund their most urgent adaptation needs. And they even set up a new fund to channel the resources to do that, called the Least Developed Countries Fund. They even gave the LDCs their own name for the fund. And it all sounded pretty good. And what's happened 10 years later, well, actually what happened next was that those LDCs were asked, go away, figure out what your most urgent adaptation needs are, write them into what we call NAPAs, National Adaptation Programs of Action, come and submit them, and we commit to fully fund them through the LDC fund. What happened, of course, they went away, they made up these plans. They're not great, these NAPAs, to be honest. We didn't know a lot about adaptation planning at that time. But nonetheless, they did them. They submitted them. The total cost of those NAPAs is something around $2 billion. It's not much. It's a one-off payment, just to try and get some sort of adaptation projects moving on the ground. And currently in the Least Developed Countries Fund, there's around about $200 million, and that's just committed. There's even less of that has actually been provided to the fund, and even less than that has actually been dispersed on the ground. So the story is of 10 years of underinvestment in adaptation, and what we can't afford is another 10 years of that kind of level of underinvestment. So that's why we're really fighting and campaigning at the moment in Oxfam for new sources of this money. We recognise that climate financing is an obligation of developed countries in view of their responsibilities for causing climate change historically and in view of their capacity to help to deal with it. And therefore, we expect them to provide that finance through budgetary contributions first and foremost. But we recognise it's not sufficient. We've already seen at the moment all they're doing is relabelling existing promises. And in the current economic climate, even in a country like here in the UK, which is one of the leaders, if you like, on development assistance, they stuck to their 0.7% commitment in spite of everything that we know is going on in the world at the moment. And they deserve a lot of credit for that, the current government. They stuck to it. But we don't have a lot of political leverage with them to now say, right, you stuck to 0.7, now we expect you to deliver even more resources on top of it. We get laughed out of the room, actually, at the moment. So we have to find new sources of the finance, aside from these traditional development finance contributions. And that's what we're really campaigning on at Oxfam. We're looking at the financial transactions tax as one of the key options, the so-called Robin Hood tax. And I hope that some of you will have seen the kind of the Robin Hood tax stuff and got involved in that campaign. So we're looking at that as one source. And we're looking, in this piece of work that I'm doing at the moment, looking at ways to raise finance from the international transport sector, aviation and shipping. We've got huge growing emissions that are not currently regulated. We can regulate those emissions in a way which also generates finance. So those are the sorts of options that we're looking at. This is one of the key issues that we're campaigning to make progress on in Durban. Happy to talk more in questions or whatever about the state of play in the UN climate negotiations. I won't go into it now because I need to wrap up. But in very broad terms, last year in Cancun, governments established a new global climate fund called the Green Climate Fund, but they didn't say where the money would come from to fill it. So we're saying that this year has to be about filling that fund. By the way, there's quite a lot of other things that need to be done in Durban that won't be done. Sadly, we need to actually increase the ambition of our emission reductions to stay below catastrophic levels of global warming. And there's the issue of saving the Kyoto Protocol. So as ever, there's a lot on government's plates in Durban. And as I say, happy to talk much more about that in the questions if people are interested. So the final thought I want to leave you with is just something to kind of think about as we get close to this summit in Rio next year. Rio Plus 20 or Rio 2012, and it's there to mark 20 years since the Earth Summit in 1992, the Earth Summit which saw the signing of the UNFCCC, the Climate Convention, the Biodiversity Convention, the Convention on Desertification, and a number of declarations. It was a really big moment, you know, heads of state and government were there. And we're 20 years on, and it's a chance to look back and see what worked, what was implemented, and it's really a chance to look forward and figure out what's changed since 1992, what in our analysis of sustainable development has changed. And the reason that I'm just going to leave you with one thought about it is because at the moment there's a real dearth of decent ideas out there about what Rio is going to deliver. Governments are not particularly excited about it. We don't expect that many leaders to attend. I think, you know, David Cameron here has said he's not going to go. Originally, there was a clash with the Queen's Jubilee, so he said, oh, I can't possibly go, the Queen's more important. And then they changed the dates of the conference, seems just to accommodate David Cameron, and they said, yeah, I'm still not going to go. So, you know, it shows that there is, you know, a lack of ambition from governments, and we all need to be part of drumming up some support and excitement about this conference, because it could, for our generation, really mark, you know, a turning point, a new definition of sustainable development in a resource-constrained world that we were talking about. So the final just kind of point to leave you with is this diagram. I mean, this for Oxfam is the kind of challenge that we see facing development for the coming decades. We need to do a number of things at the same time. We need to shrink the ecological impact of global resource use to stay within planetary boundaries. And these planetary boundaries include, for example, the amount of carbon dioxide that we can pump into the atmosphere. But actually, there's a lot of interesting work now mapping out a whole range of different planetary boundaries for different natural resource use. So we know we've got to stay within those planetary boundaries, but we've got to do that in a context in which we also redistribute resources to the least well off. So we're both trying to become more sustainable at the same time that we're trying to become more equitable. And that's a challenge which has got few historic precedents, but it's the challenge of this generation, it's the challenge of development in the years and decades ahead. And unless we get this right, the types of development issues that we've been dealing with for the past 50 or however many years are going to look nothing like the challenges ahead of us in the second half of this century, unless we get a handle on our natural resource use and make sure that it's the poorest people which are benefiting from more sustainable policies, not losing out. So I'll leave it there. I'm sorry if I overran. Thank you very much, and look forward to your questions.